You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Seth Numerick. Seth is a wonderful actor. He was 2 years ahead of me at Juilliard, and I've always admired his work. I love his thoughtfulness as an artist and his gentle energy. He has been working out of town a lot the last few years on a TV show, Turn, and now he's back, and I'm so glad because we're neighbors and we're getting to hang out and see each other so much more. It was a pleasure to sit down with him and hear about where he's at these days. And I hope you enjoy the 86th episode of The Compass. So the question I always start with is, what do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
Yeah, I know that because I'm a listener to this.
I try to keep podcast. That one the same.
And of course. Oh, and I love it. Like, I really love that you start every one with that question, because it's such a big one and such a multifaceted one, and it's so amazing to hear everyone's different reactions and what it means for them. But it also means that being a listener to the podcast, like, I've been thinking about, since you asked me to do this, I've been thinking about, you know, well, what is my, you know, what is that for me? And then starting to have these doubts or these questions of, like, you know, well, does anyone really want to hear what I have to say? Or, like, who cares?
Right.
So then in that process, in the midst of that, it's so funny because I felt myself like, oh, right, well, that's it. That's my thing.
Those questions,
those, like, doubts and self-criticisms. And so it was just interesting to, like, realize that happening, you know, in real time, as it is right now, which is amazing. And, you know, for me, thinking about it for the last few days, I find myself in an interesting place of wanting to ask, like, the reverse question of myself. How do I not avoid going to the dark side? How do I actually resist the urge to avoid it to the extent that I do? Do you know what I mean? And I think that for me is
like to acknowledge it.
Yeah, and to be there, to, like, let it be a thing that's happening for me and not cave into the urge to just try to run away from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that, well, I was thinking about Joseph Campbell and the idea of the shadow, right? Like the archetype, the idea of the shadow. And in his, I think my poor reiteration of his idea of it is that it's something that's ever present. It's always there. And that it is a part of us. And it's a part of us that can be scary and can be, you know, dark or frightening. But it also is a place of inspiration, and it's a place of unknown powers, even. He sort of talks in this way about it. And so thinking of that for myself, you know, I think I spend or have spent quite a lot of time in my adult life in darkness or in that shadow place. I deal with depression and anxiety, as so many people do, and you know, have those moments, and often my initial instinct is to just get away from it, to just, like, do what I can to solve the problem, to fix it, or to, you know, to resist it, right? And I think that I'm learning for myself in my own way that my efforts to resist oftentimes just feed the unhealthy relationship to it, you know, and that I'm neglecting it in a lot of ways. I'm neglecting, like, addressing what, you know, even just saying hello to it, like, and I think that takes a certain type of acknowledgement. I'm researching this stuff right now about dream yoga. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
No, tell me about it.
Dream yoga is something that I learned about from someone I met over the summer at this program I was working at, and he told me about this practice of dream yoga, and it's, well, there's a sort of ancient Tibetan tradition where, you know, that's how they talk about it, as a yoga in the sense of a spiritual practice of developing lucidity and recognition, consciousness within your dreams. Hmm. And then there are different approaches, different sort of ways of going about it. It's more Western approaches and then these older ways of approaching it. But finding a way to interact with your subconscious in the dream state and being able to like actually very literally confront different parts of your psyche and be with them and talk to them and recognize them for what they are, and that level of awareness is heightened when you develop the ability to be conscious of the fact that you're dreaming. Then you're right. Also able to recognize that every person, everything that you interact with is an aspect of you. It's being created by you. So there's an amazing sort of freedom and power in that on many levels, but then to be able to like actually be in conversation with something yeah. that you're afraid of, or that you don't even know what it is that you're afraid of, and being able to try to dig in to whatever the images and the experiences that your subconscious is creating around that thing. So that's something I've been thinking a lot about, and that for me, there's been, you know, darkness that comes up, or things that make me uncomfortable, things that make me afraid, and that keep me operating much of the time from a place of fear, and I want to figure out how to integrate in order to then not let those things be in the driver's seat of my experience of my life, or right. or the thing that is motivating certain decisions or certain reactions. So that's kind of where I'm at right now with that question. How do I not avoid the dark side?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I'm being sort of willfully obtuse, because obviously there are, you know, you can't operate from that place. So then there are practical things.
Yeah, what sort of practical things do you do? Yeah,
keep it simple.
Function.
Numeric.
Just... No, but I totally relate to that.
Yeah.
Of getting to the place where you're operating from.
Yeah. And I say
that just
more...
becomes your habit.
Right. And it's, of course, like, it's, you know, it's one of those things that is an unattainable goal, or it's an ever renewing process, that you're never going to like get to the point where you're not doing that. It's about addressing, understanding, raising awareness of your own behaviors and the way your mind works, to be able to, you know, at least calm it down a little bit, or have the choice in moments, yeah. you know, where
but
am
I think
I
that acknowledgement
from?
Is really healthy yeah. to be able to at least say, and it's part of why I wanted to start this podcast, is like to at least yeah. say, this is something that's hard for me.
Yeah.
Or like, this is something that, this is yeah. how I feel. And then
yeah.
just being like, oh, okay, I'm okay with that.
Right.
Or
right.
this is what I'm going to do to try to
yeah.
help
yeah.
myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And to just acknowledge that it's a part of our collective human yeah. experience.
Instead
you know,
of like, just being like, everybody. I'm so great. Right,
exactly.
I'm so happy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
All the time.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that recognition of the fact that it's something that we share has been very important to me. And when you ask about, you know, practical things, one of those things for me in the last few years that's been very important is therapy. It's just having some, you know, yeah. a professional to talk to, and finding the right person, because that's not yeah. an easy thing all the time. But
have you been able to keep that up when you're, I know you've been working out of town so much.
Yeah. So my therapist that I work with is actually based in Richmond, Virginia, because that's where I've been working part of the time for the last few years. And I developed a relationship with him there. And now we meet up on Skype when I'm not there. And, you know, I may move into something else at some point, but for right now, he's been a huge help to me. And one of those initial things that made such an impact that I wasn't expecting was to be sort of expressing frustrations and concerns and fears and letting all of that out in those, you know, first moments that you have with that someone in that kind of budding relationship. And for him to respond like, yeah, that's pretty normal.
You're like, really?
That's pretty much
I
what
thought it was a
you
monster.
Know, right? Exactly. Yeah, and you know, recognizing that these are things that everybody, we all deal with them, and yet we don't really talk about them, or it's still there's still stigma around it, and we live in a competitive world where, you know, acknowledging vulnerability and weakness is still not valued. It's not yeah. regarded, and it's, you know, it's actively shut down and opposed. So I just think any step towards that is at least a step in the right direction. And then, yeah, I mean, and then in that process and in other processes, developing other practical things. Like, I know for me that if I'm active in my body in certain ways, then that helps my brain chemistry. Or I know that cultivating mindfulness, you know, for me is something that keeps me grounded, or that I can come back to in moments where I'm losing touch with my, in moments where my doubts and my self-criticism is taking over and taking the driver's seat, and I can, you know, come back to certain things sometimes, and sometimes it crashes and burns and I spiral into my own neuroses. That happens too.
Yes.
But that's all part of it, isn't it?
It happens to all of us.
Mm. Yeah.
So I distinctly remember, this is a tangent, I distinctly remember the first time I met you, because for some reason, when I started, it was right before we started Juilliard, and we had that thing where, like, the fourth years meet the first years, or the third years meet the first years, something like that.
Yeah.
And people kept telling me, oh, I don't know if it was because I had gone to Chautauqua, and I had told people that, like, that, oh, I'd met Becky and Ralph and some of our teachers in Chautauqua, and people were like, oh, Seth went to Chautauqua, you should meet Seth, is so great, you should meet Seth. And I don't know if the home education thing had come up at that point or not, but I distinctly remember meeting you and just being like, oh, this is, like, this is my brother. And we've kept in touch here and there, and then we haven't seen each other for years, and now I'm so excited that you are living a few blocks away from us.
Mm, yeah, me too, me too.
But how did you first get into acting? That was a roundabout way of saying, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
And how did you get into acting when you were being homeschooled in the Midwest?
while we're on tangents, I want to say how glad I am to be here, and that's because of, I already just sort of said it, but how much I appreciate and respect and admire what you're doing with this, and that I love that it's radio, because radio is like a passion of mine. I'm such an audiophile. I love anything spoken word. I love radio drama, and I really lament that we don't have that in our culture. It's still a big thing in the UK. It's still a very active art form. We don't have that here anymore, but anyway, I just love listening to things.
Okay, well, at the end, if you want to recommend some things, you can let us know along those lines.
I'll think about that for sure. What was the question? about how I started acting.
Yeah, right.
So I'm so lucky and blessed with the family that I was born into, and for so many reasons, and one of those being that the arts, and specifically the performing arts, were a huge part of my life and my family all the way from the beginning. And my dad is a theater artist as well. He's an actor and a storyteller in the very literal sense, not in the sense of how we all, we're all just storytellers. Like, he's an actual storyteller.
Yeah.
And made, you know, his living for quite a while as a professional storyteller.
We used to go to the Michigan Storytellers Festival every year, and I was just blown away by those, like, professional storytellers.
Oh,
it's,
man.
Such an art form.
Yeah, and so my dad, he's an amazing guy, and he's traveled all over the world and collected stories from different cultures. He's worked a lot with certain large ethnic groups that live in the Twin Cities. He's worked with Somali groups and a lot with the Hmong community, and they're completely oral culture. They don't have a written language, so oral tradition is, you know, obviously paramount to their way of living. And so he worked a lot with folks from that culture, and and so my brother and I, being homeschooled, as you mentioned, very often were there with him for these storytelling programs, and then from there, kind of that developed into when he needed, you know, someone to. He did a lot of work with kids as well, not just storytelling, but doing conflict resolution through story and through, you know, kind of role playing and acting, basically as a form of healing and talking about trauma and self-expression, you know, arts education stuff. So we would be the ones there to, like, give the example of what, you know. So that was my kind of first experience with with being in front of people, with me and my brother kind of, you know, acting out these little plays. But then my experience just at home, you know, we would go and see plays. We would read plays together. I have distinct memories of sitting with my dad on my parents' bed in their bedroom with, like, me under one arm and my brother under the other arm, you know, next to my dad, like, with this tome of the complete works of Shakespeare, and we sit there and, like, read Shakespeare out loud. And, you know, of course, you grow up thinking that your experience is like everyone else's, and like, right. How unusual is that? And my dad wasn't really acting when I was a kid. He was running this theater company that was more about arts education and doing the storytelling work. And when I was a kid, I was very active in sports. I loved sport. I played every sport. And then when I was about 11, I had this, it wasn't an injury really, it was sort of a degenerative knee condition where like my knees got all screwed up, and it just meant I couldn't do sports anymore, like done. I'd gone from playing every sport at every different season to just like can't do any of that. Uh-huh. And so the acting thing kind of came out of like, well, what can I do that's not that's not sports? And of course, you know, having been exposed to it from a young age, I was already attracted to it, but I don't know that I would have found that at quite as naturally or at that age if I hadn't had that issue. Yeah, so I started, you know, the Twin Cities is an amazing place to grow up in terms of access to culture and theater, and the community there is incredible, and my dad's still a very active member of it. And so there was just stuff happening all the time. And I actually, my very first, I think this is right, on stage experience was with a homeschool theater group that I don't know if it exists anymore, but Theatrix was what it was called in Minneapolis. And they would sort of create or facilitate the school play experience, but for kids that didn't go right to school. So we would, you know, do these plays. And then I kind of found my way into other, you know, youth theaters in the Twin Cities, and then eventually worked at some of the more professional theaters. And so from about the age 12 on, I was just always in a play. And then another brilliant thing that my dad caught on to and figured out how to do as an educator was to, so my dad was the primary educator for us as homeschool kids. And he figured out how to almost base my curriculum in a lot of ways around the play that I was working on at any given time. So if I was, you know, I for 2 years in a row, I did To Kill a Mockingbird at a theater in Twin Cities. And so when I was studying, it was all around, you know, the civil rights movement and what was going on at that, in that place. That's awesome. And at that time, and like really dig into, so my education became focused around that. And so I have a weird, like I weirdly know a lot about certain specific things, and then there are other things that I have no idea about, which is fine. But more than anything, you know,
survived to me, song.
Right?
I have that too.
And yeah, I think maybe that's common with homeschool people. But for me, I mean, I think of education as developing a hunger for learning. You know, yeah. You're learning how,
so you
to
know how to learn.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful for that now as a professional actor, because that's what I love to do. I love to research. I love to get into a role, and in many different ways. I try to find as many ways as possible that I could think to approach something from a kind of research standpoint. And I'm so lucky to have had that kind of wired in with how my dad chose to educate. That was my initial kind of foray into that world. And again, I'm so lucky that my parents, you know, both were so supportive of that, and just that it was a thing that made sense to do, which it isn't in every family. And that my mom is also, she's not in the theater herself, but is such a lover, so passionately cares about the arts and about theater. And my mom is amazing as well. And she is actually an artist. She's an artist. She's a fabric artist. She weaves and she knits and does amazing. She spins yarn. And she's a healer. She works as a women's health nurse practitioner. And anyway, I'm just so lucky for so many reasons to have the family I do, but that the arts were encouraged and inspired. And then, you know, being homeschooled, I had a weird trajectory through education, as I think many of us do. And when I was in what would have been my sophomore year, I guess, of high school, I started thinking about college and stuff. And in Minnesota, we have weird laws around post-secondary enrollment. And so you can, if you're at a school that doesn't offer advanced placement classes, or if you're homeschooled, then you can choose to do that kind of stuff at a university. So in that year, I basically did like my what would have been my first year of undergrad at the University of Minnesota. So I was living at home, but taking all my classes at school right. and doing, you know, a full load of a full whatever you call it.
Course load.
Yeah. And as a part of that, I did some theater stuff because I knew that was, you know, where I wanted to go, basically. And it was great, and it was a lot of fun. It was such a weird shift to go from, as you know, like, nothing, you know, me and my brother to
yeah.
a lecture hall with, you know, hundreds of people. It was such a shock. But I really realized then that I wasn't interested at the time. I mean, I was so young, but I wasn't interested in a normal undergrad program. I wanted to do something more intensive. I wanted to have an acting training conservatory experience. So then that year I started thinking about schools and things, and then my dad and I drove down to the kind of consortium auditions in Chicago, you know, where they do all the auditions. Yeah. And actually I applied to Juilliard on a whim at the last minute because my parents had seen a PBS documentary about Juilliard and they're like, this place looks interesting. I was like, okay. So we sent in an application literally the day that it was due and all, you know, and I went to these auditions thinking, you know, this will be a chance to kind of go through the process and see what it's like, and then I'll come back next year and right. do it for real. And I think because I did not, really, there wasn't much writing on it for me, and I didn't prepare for it. I mean, I literally took a bag of plays in the car with me and chose monologues and the day before, and so then getting into the school, I was like totally, you know, totally shocked. And I thought that they'd made a mistake because I was so young, and I was like, did I put...
Am I allowed?
Yeah, I mean, it was very confusing, and my parent, you know, now think... At the time, it felt like a natural thing, but now looking back on it, like, I was 16 years old, and my parents just, like, drove me to New York and dropped me off, and I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
That's incredible.
That they did that. I don't think I would do that.
No, they had faith in,
I guess,
in your
yeah.
independence and yeah, in your yeah, ability. Yeah.
And in the school to, like, you know, keep me in line, I guess. but yeah, so that's, I'm answering more of a question than you actually asked.
I wanted to know all of that.
But that's, yeah.
Going back to, like, your love of research and yeah. how that served you as an actor, what are some of the ways you've found that you've had to change your process when you're doing, like, TV stuff mm-hmm. as opposed to theater? Like, have you found any tools to try to make it? I don't really have TV experience, but
yeah.
to make up for the lack of a rehearsal process. Like, how do you make it feel fulfilling
and to be prepared? I wish I knew that. I'm working on it, or I'm at least yeah. like, I don't even know if that's fair to say. I'm hopeful that there is a way.
I mean, it's kind of awesome that the show you just finished, yeah. Turn, was about a historic time period,
totally.
So I'm sure you now know all about that.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know what, even with that, funnily enough, there was a point at which I had to stop doing research because then it started to upset me so much how divergent the
right,
show
when they would veer from the truth.
Yeah, or from my idea of the truth, or I don't yeah. know. Yeah, look, it's a totally different thing in my experience. I've had very limited experience as well, and I've really only experienced one version of how a show has run for a sustained period of time. And I also know that that world is changing so much and so quickly that I think there are opportunities for things to be created and run in different ways. The way that the show that I worked on ran was really hard for me because coming from theater, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what we were supposed to do to not have a process, to not have rehearsal.
Right.
And I would look at these older actors that could do such amazing work in that context. And I'm like, well, it's clearly possible. I just don't know what to
do. I just don't know how to do this.
Like,
it's just a totally different beast.
Yeah. And I think that I'm still looking for how I find my way into feeling like I'm in a process that makes sense to me in that world. Cause I haven't had that experience yet, and I'm hopeful that it could. I think I need to be more active in pursuing it. And I think that as I study actors that I admire and look at the way that they operate as performers in those spaces, that there are ways, and that there that there are ways to do it and not be selfish about it and not mm-hmm. be, you know, demanding in an unrealistic way. And I think at the end of the day, it must come down to, you know, you can take care of what you can take care of. One of my best friends and like a brother to me and a mentor in so many ways, Daniel Talbot, who I love so dearly. And he always talks about, he's a big tennis fan, and he talks about tennis, which is also, I know nothing about tennis, but I understand what he's saying when he says you can take care of your side of the net, that you can't control what's happening on the other side of the net. But if you're taking care of your side of the net, you can be responsive to whatever is coming at you. And that's how you can stay, you know, in your own process of your work and be responsive, but not be dependent, you know, right. on whatever is happening over there. And I see people that have figured it out. And maybe I'll someday. Yeah. But it's hard. It's hard, and it's a different world. And I don't know. That's all I got.
Can we talk a little bit about like businessy financial junk?
Hmm.
I know you've had the good fortune to work a fair amount since graduating. I don't know if you've had to take side jobs or not, but also like, how have you kind of dealt with either balancing that or being a business person mm-hmm. as well as an artist in your mm-hmm. career, mm-hmm. like handled the pressures of that or the just having to deal with that side of,
right.
You know, you're not always creating. You're having to deal with a lot of middlemen and negotiations and.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a big question and one that's very present for me right now. And it very much relates to me, to what I was trying to say at the beginning of, you know, how do I find my ways to reconcile my dark side rather than to try to push it away? Because I've made sense of something recently in some way for myself about my relationship to money. Mm-hmm. And that a big part of my problem is that I'm so afraid of it. I'm so terrified of just the idea of money generally. just freaks me out, you know? Uh-huh. And everyone has their relationship to money, I think, based on maybe how you grow up or how or how you see the role models in your life deal with money. And so for me, it's one of those things that I have to work to figure out what it is about it that freaks me out so much, because otherwise in any situation it's going to be challenging for me. Right. And I say that in the sense of, and that weirdly, like when I was starting out and was, you know, had some time where I was working other jobs and, you know, any theater actor in New York, you're struggling to make ends meet all the time. And that kind of made more sense to me in some way. And then working in a different medium and in one that felt significantly less like work to me and making significantly more money, I have so many complexes around it. I feel as if I don't deserve the money that I've made on the show, because I don't feel like I can say
it's
actually
so
worked for it. Yeah, it's so extreme and it's so confusing and you're like, this is just doesn't make any sense to me. So I have real issues around money and it results in me like not taking care of it, not knowing, you know, yes, I do have money. I am financially stable for the first time in my life from having worked on this show, but I still like pay my credit cards late because I'm kind of a mess when it comes to that. But that's one of those things that I think I'm prone to think about things of in terms of if this were different, it would be easier. And in many ways, it absolutely, of course, it's easier to have money than
right, like if
to
this,
not.
If the system, or, the system or, is an ideal, so how do I deal with it? Like that?
Well,
you mean?
What I mean is for me, when I was struggling and didn't have money and was worried about how to pay rent, then an idea of, well, if I could get this type of job and then I could get paid that type of money, and then my anxiety around my money would go away, right? And that's not true. That's not true for me. Yeah. For me, you know, it's certainly easier, of course, to be secure in that way. But it doesn't mean that my anxiety about it is going to go away, or it doesn't mean that my relationship to it is any healthier. So I kind of am in this place of like, well, wherever you are with what you're dealing with, you know, how do I can I actually be present for what that is. Otherwise, it's not going to change even if my circumstances change. Or there's always going to be a different idea of if I had that or if I did this or whatever, it'll be different. What, will it? Because I haven't actually addressed my personal relationship to it. So that's kind of the journey I'm on there with my, I know it doesn't really answer your question. I think that when it comes to, business, I'm not a business person. It doesn't make sense to me. I'm not a mathematical person. I don't, you know, my aptitude for numbers, is very low. and even just thinking in the way of finance or business, it just is all like, it means nothing to me. And when I meet people who are economists or work in certain, I'm like, what is that? What does that mean? It doesn't make any sense in my head. And it, to me personally, it's those ideas or my ideas of it are very incongruous with my ideas of the creative process and art as I see it. They don't make sense to me in tandem. So the idea of seeing yourself as a business person in a creative industry is very hard for me to reconcile. And I think that for me, it leads my brain down paths that make me uncomfortable, but I think in a bad way. and that the times that I have either had to or chose, I mean, ultimately I always choose to engage with sort of that side of the world that we exist in, I get very frustrated and anxious because it feels like I'm spending more and more of my time doing work that to me isn't the work, the work of creation, and that so easily that side can take up all of your time and be the dominant output of energy, and that feels backwards to me. And so I'm in pursuit of ways to be more engaged, you know, creatively and less engaged in that. But again,
have you found ways to have those relationships with the people who help actors, like with agents or managers, or relationships that are productive for you so they can help with those things, but you still feel like you're voicing what's important to you, standing up for yourself, even if you don't speak the language of the financial side of it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When they're thinking about that stuff.
Yes, yeah. I'm also very lucky in that way that I've had the same representation since I left school, and I have a really, really great relationship with those people, and they're very dear to me, and I trust them very much, and I trust that they understand me in certain ways, and I trust that they understand that I'm not interested in certain things, and so they kind of like deal with things so that I don't, that, you know, because they know that I won't or that I can't. So I'm lucky to be in a position to be able to trust those people. I've always, knock on wood, been fortunate in how well they, or how hard they work to understand kind of what I'm interested in and where I'm coming from and how to facilitate that. And it took time at the beginning because, you know, it's like any kind of relationship that you have to find your way into mitigating expectations and, you know, what's their interest versus what's your interest, and how do they come together and how do you resolve that in a way that's productive. And but again, I'm so lucky because they're like really great people that that I really care about, and that makes all the difference, you know?
Yeah, that's so huge.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about your collaborative relationship with Daniel, who you mentioned, because he was on episode 35 of The Compass, if you want to go back and listen to it. But I know, like, right out of school, you did a ton of his plays.
Yeah.
Did you guys meet? He wasn't at school when you were at school.
He had graduated the year before I got there, so I didn't know him until the fourth year. And a wonderful actor named Brian Smith, who was in my class, had done a play with him before he came. Before, it was in the year between when Daniel had graduated and before Brian came to school. They did a play in, I want to say, at the Alley Theater together. So they had become close, and then Daniel came to see Brian in plays, and was around a bit, and I met him that way. And then he invited me to do a first it was a reading, I guess, and then a workshop of his play Slipping, which mm-hmm. now I've, you know, been involved in a couple of different ways and at different times in different places. And I would keep doing every year if I could, but I'm too old now to be.
Is that the one that you and Adam did together?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
That Rattlestick?
Exactly, yeah.
I remember that.
It's a beautiful play. It was Daniel's, I don't know if it was his first play, but I think it might have been the first play that was produced, and they did it at the Royal Court when he was still in school, actually, on a summer. He spent in London and did it there. Anyway, yeah, he asked me to be involved, and I read the play and was just so kind of moved and heartbroken by it and by his writing. He's an incredible writer, and his work on the page is unlike any other that I've ever seen in theater or elsewhere. And the more I get to know Daniel, the more his writing makes sense to me in a way, because it's so deeply personal, and it's so but it's so beautifully universal in at the same time, which is what I think great writers have, an ability to be so specific and so true to their own experience, but translated in a way that feels human in a broader sense. Anyway, yeah, I just became so, so grateful to him. He has a real capacity for nurture and mentorship, and he understands and has imbued in me a feeling of the value of that in the arts and in what we do, and how, and then, you know, once you have that sense of value, something you recognize that it's lacking so often, that mm-hmm. sense of mentorship and apprenticeship and that there's something that we need that in the theater, that it's become so competitive, and so like everyone's trying to find their place, which of course and that's bound to happen, but he's a person that creates places for people to be and to work in a way that just that makes sense to me, that's very collaborative, very in dialogue, and you know, that's what it's about, in my opinion. That's the whole point of what we do, and that's part of what I struggle with in working on TV, that it doesn't feel that quite so much that way in the experiences that I've had. But I think a lot of the way that I think about it, Daniel has had a huge impact and contributed to that in many ways, and he's someone that I hope I'll get to keep working with forever.
Yeah, it's amazing to have those relationships, especially with a writer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you keep kind of coming back to each other, you know how to work together.
Yeah, and that's that's something that we've sort of moved away from as the theater becomes, in my opinion, as it becomes more institutionalized and forced to become more commercial, that the sense of a company, a sense of a cohort of artists that have a rapport with each other, that develop, you know, we don't really have repertory theater very much in this country anymore. And that ability to create shorthand and to have time to develop artistic relationships and then see what can come out of that. And of course, the more time that you have to put into that, the more you'll reap the fruit of it. And I think it's really special, and I'm realizing how lucky I am as I sit here and talk about all these
that's
things.
Beautiful.
Grateful. Yeah,
that's kind of one of the best things about my time at Juilliard, was having that time to work with an ensemble for 4 years, the same people for 4 years, who sometimes drive you crazy,
of
but
course,
you really get to that point. We have that shorthand.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what it's about. It's about also the parts of that you drive each other crazy, because that's a truthful human experience. And if you can experience that together with someone else and get through it and keep going, then you have something more about what that means between you and that person. And then you have an ability to work with them in a certain way that goes just a little bit deeper. So you keep kind of in the good and the bad, you're getting deeper in what you can explore with those people, I think.
Is there something you're proud of from the last couple of years that you want to tell me about? It doesn't have to be a big thing. It could be like a lesson you've learned or...
I'm not sure that proud... The thing that jumps to mind, and then when I think of whether I'm proud of it or not, I don't know that it totally makes sense, but I just got back... I'm not sure if I've talked to you about this yet, but from this program that I got to... This workshop that I got to go and do in Italy with the Work Center of Jerzy Grotowski, if you know about that company. Mm-hmm. They're based in Italy, and it's the Work Center of Jerzy Grotowski and Thomas Richards, who is the person who took over for Grotowski when he died. Grotowski, for listeners that don't know, was a Polish theater maker, one of the most influential theater makers of the 20th century, and very, very prominent in European theater and in the sort of philosophy of theater. He was one of the most famous directors in the world, and then basically walked away from a professional career as a director and like literally ran away to the woods with a group of young actors and wanted to dedicate his life to exploring the craft of acting, of theater making. And for years and years and years, they didn't perform ever. They were just in research and in rehearsal and in development and in training. And there's a book called Towards a Poor Theater that he wrote sort of early on in that exploration, and then he continued in his work. He died in the 90s, and then this guy, American guy named Thomas Richards, took over the company. They're based in Italy in the Tuscan countryside, and and I saw them. I was lucky enough to be in Edinburgh last year at the festival, and they brought some work, or they were hosted by Rose Bruford College to do some of their repertory at the festival at the Fringe, and I saw this piece that they had created that. Going into it, I didn't know anything about it other than it was based on Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, okay. Which I vaguely remember from college, and that it was going to be 3 hours long with no intermission, and that it was that there was no production value at all, no like sets or lights or anything. So I walked in, I'm like, oh my god, I was downing coffee beforehand, like sitting in the front row, I'm like, I can't fall asleep, and. If I could have sat there for another 3 hours, I would have. I mean, my jaw was on the floor. The work that these performers were embodying was so unbelievable to me and so moving and so foreign and yet familiar at the same time. And they work a lot with song. They do this ancient. They sing these ancient vibratory songs, but they also have this incredible character work. And it was, I mean, desperately funny. And I was in tears as well. It was an incredible performance, incredible piece of theater, and I was just, like, shaking afterwards. I was so excited by it. And so I kind of became obsessed with them, and then kept looking at their workshops to see if I could find a time to go and just learn from them and try to get a little bit closer to understanding what was going on there. And so, I got back a few weeks ago from spending 2 weeks in Italy with this company and training and sort of scratching the surface of the work that they've been developing for, a long time, and it's the hardest thing I've ever done as an actor, and it required me to write, which I'm afraid of doing, and I don't have a practice of. I was writing material for myself to perform in a one-person performance capacity, which I'm also terrified of and have no real interest in, it was all these things that just scared the living daylights out of me, and I was there for 2 weeks, and I couldn't imagine how these people live and do this work every day of their lives.
Oh my goodness.
They're like monastics, essentially. I mean, their dedication to this practice is so deep and so profound, and they're getting at something. It's very hard to articulate, but they're getting at something very primal, I think, about mm-hmm. the human impulse to share stories and to perform and to sing and to be together in a way where the context is heightened into an imaginary or a spiritual realm that they see, I think, or my experience of being in this place, that's what they're interested in. And it's more like a monastery than any theater that I've ever been to, quite honestly. And the work is so profound. So I guess in a way I'm proud, I guess, of just having gone to do. I'm proud of not leaving. That's a good way.
But, no, but what you're talking about, like acknowledging fear facing fear, and you did something totally. That was really scary.
Because there were moments in there where I was like, this is, I don't know, why am I here? What am I doing?
Yeah.
And it very much became about that. It became about confronting my doubts and my fears and then sort of working through that and finding what's on the other side of that in this context was really, really heavy for me. And again, I feel like I've only sort of scratched the surface of kind of what they're about. So, you know, it's something I want to keep thinking about, keep chewing and working amazing. On.
Mm-hmm. How many people are in the group there? The company?
So the company has two separate... Oh, you know what? I should plug this because one of the two groups that comprises this company is going to be spending time in New York in September and October. And they're going to be doing these open... they call them open choir, these open singing sessions. And I think it's going to be in the Bronx. I'll try to give you more specific.
Yeah, when you find out, let me know.
Yeah, but if you go on the Work Center of Jerzy Kratofsky's site, and one of their two groups will be traveling to New York, and I'm sure there'll be dates and things on there. So there's two separate groups. I'd say there's maybe 10 to 12 company members in each of those two groups. And then there were... like 40 of us, I think, there as workshop participants. And we kind of worked with the directors of the two groups and then with the company members and kind of got a glimpse into how they work and what they do. And it was amazing.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never been to Edinburgh.
Oh.
I feel like I've talked to someone else recently about it on the podcast.
Yeah. Charlie Russell, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard her. I haven't seen that show yet, but I've heard it's amazing.
It's a lot of fun.
Yes, I remember her, and it's true, everything she said, that festival is amazing. It's a really... I've been there twice to perform and two other times just to go and see stuff, and it's crazy. It's enormous and overwhelming, but it's one of those places where if ever I'm feeling doubtful or that I've lost a sense of hope in our art form... It's so affirming to be in a place where 500,000 people descend for a month every summer to celebrate live performance.
I'm just excited about it.
I mean, how amazing is that?
Not because it's a famous play.
No, yeah.
Not because there's a celebrity in it.
Yeah, and of course it has its own politics and its own weird stuff. And there's, you know, there's a lot of terrible things there that, you know, whatever. That's part of the fun of it as well, is not knowing. But some of the most incredible work I've ever seen has been... there. And it's an ability as an American artist to expand your idea mm-hmm. of what the process is. And, you know, things that I think I in the past have taken for granted as, oh, well, this is how you do things. And then seeing other things from other places and realizing, oh, this is how we normally do things in our culture or in our dominant, you know, pieces of art in this field in America. But that doesn't mean that's how it does done. I mean, these people are approaching it from a totally different place. And it just, for me, it expanded my idea of what, you know, what the work can be. And I find that so inspiring.
This is actually, I wasn't planning to ask you this, but speaking of Charlie's episode, could I ask you about what it was like when you did your show, the play you did in London, to be an American actor working in London? Because I got her perspective as a British actor here in New York. But I feel like it doesn't happen quite as often for American actors to do a show in London. What was that like?
Yeah, I'm again, so lucky to have gotten to get to work over there a couple of times. I've done two plays there and a couple up in Scotland. And it's a very different experience. And I love London, and I love the theater culture that exists there, and partly because it's less separate from the rest of the culture. Like, theater is a part of the culture there, I think, in a way that it is is struggling to find or to maintain that relevance in the broader culture. And I have, how much time do you have? Because I have a lot of opinions about this. I think a lot of it comes down to money, right? That in a culture where there's still some value in the art form as a public good and as a necessity, right, or as something that's important for people to experience, you know, that means that there's a sliver of money, a sliver of budget somewhere in the federal and local governments that goes to those pursuits. And we've all but lost that in this country. And over there, of course, I went over there thinking like, oh, well, it's a free-for-all and everybody gets all the money they want to do art. Of course, that's not the way it is there. And there, they're very afraid, as you know, as is right to be, that they're losing the arts funding. But there's still, right now at least, for the time being, there's just enough that a handful of theaters over there are able to have just enough of their budget covered that they're able to take more risks in the work that they do, be more imaginative in the scope of the work. You know, I think here in New York, it's as a my playwright friends talk about that, you know, they're often told don't write a play with more than three characters in one location because it's not going to get produced, right? So there's slightly less of that pressure there, and they can keep their ticket prices lower. So on two levels, that on one level it means that the theaters that don't work in that model, the commercial theaters, which there are plenty of, the West End, and you know, more theaters than not are commercial, are the same as Broadway or off-Broadway here. But those theaters have to compete with the theaters that do have the funding, right? So if you're a West End producer and you're going to put up a play that is boring and old or whatever, not that interesting, and you're going to charge £100 for a ticket, people aren't going to go because they're going to go to the National Theatre or the Donmore or the Almeida or places where you can get in for 10, 15, 20 pounds, right, and you can see something that's, you know, pushing an envelope or being risky or doing something more unique or more interesting. So there's a check and balance there that we don't have here. Everything has gone up and up and up and up. And off-Broadway is just as bad as Broadway now, that it's so expensive to go and see a play. And so then they need to find the people that are going to be the sure ticket sell. You know, it's just trending upward in a way that has nothing to anchor the other side of it, I think. And the other part of it is that it means that people have access to the theater. And theater is, the art form is reflective of who is seeing, of the culture, right? And in our culture, there's a barrier to entry. Most people can't afford to go to the theater, especially in New York, and it's a problem in other cities as well, but especially here. Normal people don't go to the theater because I most of the time I can't afford to go to the theater and I'm a working actor. That's, you know, it's not right. It shouldn't be that way.
No, it's usually like when you get comps through somebody.
Right, or exactly. It's crazy. And so it then becomes, it's there's no way to avoid the process then of it becoming a hall of mirrors between what's on stage and who's in the audience.
Yeah.
And the narrower the scope, the spectrum of people that can be in the audience, then the narrower the scope of the work is going to be. It's very clear, I think. And so then when you see work that's being made in a culture where that pressure is there, but it's alleviated just enough that there can be other voices. And I mean, I got to be in a play called War Horse, and that to me is a perfect example because that play started in the basement of a room in the basement of the National Theater with these two great directors, but who were not, you know, big name directors in the UK at the time. And they came to them and said, we've got this crazy idea about having a play where the main character is a horse that doesn't talk and it's going to be a puppet. I mean, that's insane. And in this country, it wouldn't happen. I'm sorry. I don't think it would.
Well, it shows that these shows, they get developed there.
Exactly.
They get given a chance in England.
Yeah.
And then when they're a huge hit,
exactly. Yeah.
Broadway's like, give it to me. Let me charge a ton of money.
Yeah. And while I was doing that play, I talked at length to anyone that would listen about why it's important to invest in developing, but in an authentic way.
Yeah.
Because they could dream into that idea as they played with it and explored and said, oh, this is working, this isn't working. They could dream into what the scope of it could be. And then ultimately it became, you know, something that was lucrative and toured the world, but that also wasn't their goal. They were trying to tell a story in a way that made sense to them as artists.
No, and you see that, I mean, you can see that right now with Natasha Pierre, but that is few and far between.
Yeah, yeah.
Few and far between.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's a whole but that as well is like now struggling to stay afloat on Broadway. It's a brilliant piece of theater. It's beautiful.
The measure of what quote-unquote success is.
Right.
How much money is coming in each week.
Exactly.
When to me, it's one of the most successful plays I've seen in years.
Yeah, and I just think maybe our barometer is off somehow. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it ties into so much about the world that is outside of the, you know, what we're talking about right now, and which is another part of life that I have been that we all, you know, right, that we're all sort of working maybe to figure out what our place as, well, I'm interested in what my place as an artist is in social movements, you know, where are we right now in the world, and what do we as artists have to contribute to imagining a different world. And I was just listening to a beautiful interview with this filmmaker named Josh Fox. Do you know who he is?
No.
He's done some incredible, he's an incredible documentarian. I'd recommend all of his work. He's a passionate environmental activist and as well as an indigenous rights activist. And his newest film is called Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. And he's just an amazing guy. He was being interviewed by Nina Turner, who's another incredible woman who I hope runs for president, and I will be out on doors knocking on doors for her. They were talking about, you know, what does it mean to be in a social movement? What does it mean to be a part of, you know, the word resistance is a hot thing right now. But what does that really mean?
Right.
And he was talking about the need for to work at what you're passionate about and find the way that it relates to your place as a citizen of your city, of your country, of the world. Because many times, you know, I feel
it's
like,
well,
what am I doing? I'm here playing play pretend, and and there's so much happening in the world that I feel like, how can I be useful? And
well,
you know,
that, I mean, that's a fantastic question. I feel like, I know you've done work with A-Step in the past, mm-hmm. Artists Striving to End Poverty, but now is a particular moment in history.
Mm.
Is it something you're just pondering, or have you found any resources that might be helpful to people?
I mean, for me, the moments that I've felt myself creeping towards some type of clarity,
uh-huh.
or some type of deepening understanding of what that, of even just what that
like
question is for me, is just when I intentionally put myself in proximity, when I intentionally find my way into experiences and situations where, and it's of course aligned with like my personal, what I am passionate about in terms of social justice and human rights, and finding my way to get closer to the, because something that I find interesting about the moment that we're in is that after the election, there was this groundswell of a desire to get involved, right? To like, let's do something. And that's amazing. Like, that's so beautiful. And I feel like as well, in conversation, there was a lot of a sense of like, well, we have to figure out what to do, right? And there were times where I stepped back and was like, wait a minute. None of the battles are different on November 9th than they were on November 8th. They might be more urgent. They're more dangerous for sure for certain people. It's scarier, and the tactics are going to be different, but the fights have been there and they will continue to be there. And there are people that are doing the work and have been. And so there was a bit of a sense of like, well, someone should be doing this. And like, I bet you someone is doing that.
Right.
And how do you find your way to offer what you have
to
those people? And we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
True.
You know, it's happening, and what are our ways to just show up and just support? And you know, I've tried to find moments to do that, because then when you do, then it changes. Then, you know, it becomes clearer what is actually, you know, what is the fight actually? What is the struggle? And the closer I can be to it, in whatever that means, I think physical proximity is valuable in that way, and is the only version that makes sense to me, because right. I'm not an online person so much, then you learn and you figure out how you can be useful to it.
This is fantastic. I have many things that I wish I could ask you, but I'm going to go to the end, because we've talked for an hour.
Oh, boy.
And, wow. We have talk. Other things to do.
Yes, we do.
we're going to have game night, game night. Okay, so I got board games, and I'm excited, and Seth and his girlfriend are going to play them with Frankie.
Yes.
So the last two questions, we talked a little bit about this earlier, but are there any tangible things that you reach for on a day when you're in the dark side, or when your anxiety is overwhelming, that can help you feel a little bit more grounded?
Yeah, for me, you know, being outside and then in terms of like practical things, I early on in my sort of searching for spiritual connectedness, I was introduced to Thich Nhat Hanh and his writing. He's a Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk, and continues to be an activist, and he was nominated by Dr. King for the Nobel Prize. He did incredible work during the war in Vietnam in working with people in his country. He ultimately was exiled, and just an extraordinary thinker and person. And he's written many books and has an incredibly lucid way of expressing ideas that can be very simple and yet impossible to understand at the same time. And for me, the way that he talks, the way that he expresses ideas, I find very inspiring. I listen to Krista Tippett a lot. Do you listen to On Being? I always almost say Speaking of Faith, because that's what it used to be called, but On Being is her show. And yeah, she has people that on her show that think in such incredible ways, and every time I listen to it, I feel like my perspective shifts in a beautiful way. And then like dumb things like eating chocolate or watching
it's
Netflix.
Not dumb.
It's a very important part of life.
And then finally, is there anything of any art form that you want to recommend? You mentioned that documentary, Awesome.
Yeah. Gosh, you know, I've been away from the city for so long that I'm not really keyed into... I haven't seen theater since I've been back here. And
you mentioned the radio drama world.
Yeah.
Is there anything on that end?
Well, I mean, if you can find BBC Radio 4 is usually where the radio dramas are aired. But it's amazing. There's still a whole... I mean, people write radio plays, and they're it's a completely thriving art form over there, that it's not any longer over here. Now, I used to stay up at night. There was a radio station when I was a kid that used to play like old radio, like classic radio dramas and comedies. At like 11 o'clock at night, so I would be up there with my radio.
From Minneapolis, did you ever, were you
into Prairie Home Companion? My dad is I believe a background artist in the Prairie Home Companion film that they made a few years ago.
I love that movie.
Totally grew up with that, and it's my preferred way of consuming media is through my ears. I don't know why that is, but I guess theater is probably preferred over that, but but after that, I would encourage people to check out these open choir sessions with the Work Center folks when they come through town, because there's something really moving to me about what they create in a room with bodies and voices. And the kind of collective experience that can happen there that I've witnessed and been a part of. And I'm excited for them to come, because I want to go back and just be in that room again. And it's totally outside of maybe quote unquote normal understanding of theater. You know, you're not going to go sit down in an auditorium and see performance, you're going to, you know, if you go to one of these, you're going to be a part of something and you'll be singing and you'll be moving.
And you don't have to be a singer.
No, yeah, no. It's very much, yeah, it's not about the sound, I don't think, that's coming out. It's sort of about how and where it's vibrating in you and in and amongst the people there in the room. So that's something that was really exciting for me, and I would love to share with other people.
Amazing. Seth, thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.